This Week in Retronauts, please tell me the answer. Is fate unchangeable? Everyone, and welcome to a delightful, exciting, and downright lovable episode of Retronauts. I am Jeremy Parrish, who also is downright lovable. And with me are some equally cuddly people to talk about Suikoden 1 and 2. So let's sound off, shall we?
Hey, it's Bob Mackey, and I'm really looking forward to Konami's erotic violence Suikoden pinchinko machine. I fucked that up. It's going to happen.
That's okay. It's talking about Konami. It's going to happen.
It's going to happen. I'll take both.
This is Shane Bettenhausen, who's already interested to hear how differently you guys have pronounced Suikoden and Suikoden. And it's like,
my favorite is Suikoden. That's what the guys at Babbage's called it when I was, you know, actually the games were new and I was buying them.
I worked there when it came out and a guy was like, hey, you guys got that.
That was also good because when Suikoden 2 started to go up in price, sometimes you would go onto eBay. If you did a search for Suikoden, you would find it for very cheap because no one was looking for Suikoden.
I worked at GameStop.
I got some cheap copies of Suikoden 2
when first one came out and it was, you got that Suikoden or you got that S-word game.
Yeah.
Suikoden sounds like a Japanese meal.
A Norse god.
It's actually, yes.
Like raw fish and soup or something?
Sukiyaki.
Oden. Yeah. The stupid can of whatever garbage. This is Shivan Putt, and I'm here to get all the squirrels.
Okay. And which star of Destiny are you, Shivan?
Isn't this your favorite series of all time?
Yeah, but like there's like 108 of them.
I know. So there's a lot of choices. You can just make one up.
Was it the... No, I can't. Now I will lose my cred forever. you know what? I have failed.
Wow. Okay. Well, this episode's over. I brought in the heavy hitters and they blew it.
Let's say the duck guy.
Okay.
That's the wrong
story.
I thought you meant the actual name of the stars, like the Torre stars.
Yeah, there's like a name for each star.
I'm going to be the Tenkai star because that means outside of heaven, right?
The Tenkai, isn't that like the hero star? And then like this.
Oh, yeah, that's me.
Tenkai star and the hero.
You are a hero.
I'm the hero of this episode. I'm the protagonist.
Yeah.
And if you are very, very good when you listen to the follow-up episode, you can bring me on.
Wait, we're doing
bring over your save file.
Do I have to do the Suikoden 3 episode? Do I
really absolutely.
Oh my god, I love Suikoden 3 so much.
We gotta talk about the duck guy. Forgot about the duck guy.
Let's talk about the good Suikoden.
All right. Anyway, so yeah, we are going to talk about Suikoden 1 and 2. We did an episode on the Suikoden series back during the 1UP days. It's been more than a decade.
Was I on that?
No, but I was.
No.
Okay, good.
But before we start talking about Suikoden, I do want to talk about something else very briefly. And that is paying tribute to someone who was on the original Suikoden episode. Former 1UP and Ziff Davis copy editor Andrew Fitch was on the original Suikoden episode. And I'd forgotten about that until I started to do research. And very sadly, Andrew recently passed away of cancer. And if I'm not mistaken, that makes him the first person to have been a somewhat regular contributor to Retronauts who is no longer with us.
And he was on many other podcasts as well.
Yeah, he was. He was on like all the podcasts basically at various points.
Even the sports one, right?
Yeah. He was a big sports fan. Yeah. So he was on that a lot and he was always giving his love advice.
Right. Well, and those of us who worked with him at Ziff, you know, I fondly recall editing his work and also, you know, having fun times with him in Japan and in London, he was a fan of music and the arts and film and had lots of opinions. And he and his brother were, you know, really just a fun duo to hang out with back then.
Yeah, they were twins, and they couldn't have been more different than one
That's
another.
That's true.
Their personalities are so different.
I never worked with Andrew at 1UP or anything or at Ziff, but after trying to work at Ziff for like 3 or 4 years, I eventually moved out to California to work at Atlas, and he was the first person I saw there. We started on the same day, working on the same project, so it was weird to be like a fan of all the podcasts, and on the first day, my coworker is Andrew Fitch, and we worked together for almost a year. So yeah, I have a lot of good memories of that.
Yeah, Andrew was great because he was a very shy person, but once you like kind of broke through that, he was very, very outgoing and very opinionated, and he'd like get into these kind of frothy rants, and he'd start tripping over himself. And
yes,
like he was just really fun to have conversations with him. And you mentioned going to Japan with him, and that's always something that kind of made me angry is that in 2008, he paid his own way to go help us cover Tokyo Game Show.
That sounds like the Games
Press. Yeah, the company wouldn't cover him. So he went on his own. And then like 4 months later, he got laid off in the big, you know, the big one-up layoffs. And that always pissed me off. I was like, someone who puts their neck out like that for the company should not get screwed over like this. Yeah. But it was great hanging out with him because he was actually very, very conversant with Japanese language and culture. And very familiar with Japan itself. So he was kind of like, you know, even though I'd been quite a few times at that point, I was still like learning new stuff from him. And I had a great time hanging out with him outside the show.
Yeah, he was incredibly insightful and had a huge depth of knowledge. And like, you know, his localization skills were there. And more importantly, though, for me personally, he had always been really kind because I was always just a plucky intern at 1UP or like, you know, freelance writer or whatnot. And he was always so helpful and so just like – supportive of me as like, you know, trying to get in and stuff and just didn't need to, but he was always very, very kind to all of us.
Yeah, he had a sarcastic streak, but he would only be sarcastic if he knew that you could take it.
Right.
Like I never saw him, you know, talking down to anyone or being mean to anyone. It was more like, you know, someone he was comfortable with and felt like he can take a few barbs and he'll throw a few back.
Yes, very, very much so.
What's funny, my favorite memory of he and his brother was I think it was either 2004, 2006, one of those years. We had decided – he and I were both big fans of the Brit pop band Blur who had broken up. They had broken up for I think at this point almost, you know, at least 5 years, if not 6 or 7 years. And they'd announced a reunion show in Hyde Park in London in the summer. And he and I bought tickets to go see this show and he and his brother – And I ended up there and we went to this concert and had an amazing time at the show, super fun. And then afterwards, he had like found some guy off the old NeoGAF forum and like we met up with this guy who we met on the forum and we talked about video games and we're drinking and had this great night. And I just had this wonderful memory like trapped in time of like this night in London with the Fitches and yeah, rest in peace, man.
Yeah, I think – oh, sorry.
Well, in case people don't know, Andrew actually worked on the localization of Suikoden 5. Mm-hmm. So yes. You can read his text in that game and you can also read his text in the – I think it's still running. It probably isn't actually. The Atlas Online RPG Pandora Saga is what he worked with me on. So I don't know if that's still running, but it's free. So check it out.
Yeah. So just given the coincidence, I just wanted to take a moment to stop and remember Andrew. Mm-hmm. And I think everyone who knew him or worked with him or even just listened to him on podcasts or read his writing, I think he touched everyone. So he's definitely missed. And if you are interested in hearing Andrew's opinions on the Suikoden series, since he can't be with us now, go back to archive.org and look up Retronauts episode 67 on Suikoden. Yep. And he'll be there and you can hear his kind of insider insights onto the series.
That was March of 2009, in case you're wondering.
It was super fun because when he had passed, I went and looked back at that because I had also guessed it on that episode. And to hear super young version of myself just so excited to be in the presence of somebody who worked on one of my favorite series of all time and who, you know, had been a coworker. And it was just like, you can hear me tripping all over myself. And he's like, no. But chill, it's okay. Come on. Oh, but say good end. So good. RIP, Mr. Fitch. Mm-hmm.
So let us move along to talk about the Suikoden series and – well, specifically Suikoden 1 and 2 because those are the ones I've played the most and they're the ones I love the most and they are kind of a set. In fact, as I was researching this episode, Suikoden 1 and 2 really are of a pair because the writer and designers for the series, Yoshitaka Murayama and Junko Kawano, like they originally conceived the game Suikoden 2. That was like the idea they had and they wanted to tell that story, but they didn't have experience creating an RPG. And so they wanted to get it right. And instead of just like jumping, you know, feet first into this huge sprawling RPG, they said, why don't we create sort of like a prologue story? Why don't we, you know, kind of cut our teeth by creating a smaller game that explores some of the same principles and concepts, but is, you know, like a manageable process,
I'll say that plan was not apparent. You know, like that was not revealed at the time.
No. 'Cause
like to take the gentle listener back to 1995 – and, you know, Paris, you and I were there. You didn't have a PS1 quite at launch, but you were paying attention to it, right? And like I think all of us who were fans of Japanese role-playing games on Super Nintendo and Sega Genesis were, you know, keeping a keen eye on things like Ark the Lad, Beyond the Beyond, the first two JRPGs that had been announced for this new console from Sony, and then Wild Arms. But here comes this one. You see a screenshot of, you know, Suikoden, and it looks good. It looks like a traditional 2D hand-drawn
JRPG. It looks like Luffy or something.
It looks like Luffy or something. But then Konami has never made it an RPG. Like, you know, Capcom.
They had, but not that it had been
published in America.
In the US.
Right. For those of us here in America, it's like, you know, we have a great respect for Konami, but you know, it's not a publisher or developer you associate with role-playing games. It's not Square. It's not even Capcom who had made.
We never got Cave Noir.
Right. You know, Capcom had made like Dust Saber Emperor and stuff. There's like
Breath of Fire.
Breath of Fire. So there was a little bit of, I was a little wary, like, oh, well, Konami makes great stuff. I'm excited for Castlevania, but like with them making an RPG, I was slightly wary of the announcement of this game.
And the cover art for Suikoden 1 might be one of the worst arts of all time.
In America, yeah. But the Japanese cover art's great. The art is good.
Somehow the first Suikoden was one of the first two games I bought for PlayStation. When I got my PS1, I dumped my N64 after sucking all the content out of Mario Kart 64 and Mario 64. I was like, this console just isn't for me. So I traded it, got a PlayStation, and bought Tomb Raider and Suikoden. And didn't really know much about either one except that Tomb Raider was super hyped and Suikoden was super not hyped.
There was no hype for Suikoden.
But it just like I had discovered recently, hey, I really like RPGs, so this seems promising. I wasn't sure about that Revelations Persona game. I don't know. But
which
this one
came out the same day.
Yeah. Like this one seemed promising. And
it's also, I remember that day in America because I already worked at GameStop when this came out. Suikoden came out the same day as Revelations Persona and I believe Dark Savior for the Saturn. Like it was like a great JRPG day. And like Suikoden was like, you know, instantly the best RPG on PlayStation 1 because some of us had suffered through Beyond the Beyond. This is a much better game than Beyond the Beyond.
Oh, boy.
Yeah, Beyond the Beyond I picked up later and was not impressed in the least. I don't like Camelot RPGs.
Any of them?
I know people love Golden Sun, but I hate them. They're so interminable.
The only good Camelot RPGs are the golf RPGs
and
the tennis
RPGs.
If
sports are involved, like that's what really gets me. I don't like sports. I don't like Camelot RPGs, but you combine Camelot and sports and hey, it's fun.
Well, and Shivam didn't reference the terrible box art in America, which looks like a romance novel or something.
Mm-hmm. A bad romance novel.
Like a bad Harlequin romance.
Novel done by the cover art guy of Mega Man 2.
Yeah, you know? It's really bad.
Yeah, it takes the teenage protagonist of Suikoden and turns him into like this beefy
– wrinkled.
Yeah, like his name is like Beef Super Chunk or something.
And there's like, you know, a sultry looking kind of like belly dancer lady. And anyway –
the game, like you can point at all the characters and you're like, oh, I know which character in the game this is, but what the hell?
But then you boot the game up and surprise, it just looks like a really good 16-bit RPG. And I think that's the refreshing piece to me at the time was, oh, they're not trying to make polygons here. They're like – they're just doing what they're good at and making good anime-looking 2D art.
Yeah, so the thing about Suikoden 1, so when I was in Calculus in I think 1996, 7, something like that, we were all like, you know, JRPG nerds. We had been passing around Final Fantasy VII, Final Fantasy Tactics. And then one of my friends came up and said, dude, you got to try this. And he pushed this game into my hand. And when you fire it up, it doesn't look like Final Fantasy VII or Tactics, but it looked like what you would expect if a Super Nintendo game had been pushed all the way to the top.
So you played this after Final Fantasy VII and Tactics?
Yeah.
And you still found this to be your favorite
PS1
RPG?
Because the music of this game just took me away.
I'm glad you have him on this podcast because I'll say I'm kind of an empirical from floating from above fan of Suikoden 1 and 2. I think they're great games, but I've never been one of these people. And I've had many friends growing up. One of my best friends across the street, Todd Morton, you're out there. Suikoden is like his jam. I watched him play through Suikoden 1 and 2 like 100 times and like – I respect these games, but like some people really glommed onto this. Like this is their jam, and I think for them it was not the music usually, but it was the 108 characters. Okay. That is the secret to the appeal of these games.
But having a lot of characters in an RPG doesn't make a good RPG.
For some people,
Chrono Cross, no thanks.
Let me answer Shane here. So here's the thing about Suikoden. Before we even talk about just detail, why would this game grab you? One, it's got 108 characters. But these characters are not just carbon copy clones of each other. If you put them in different combinations, you can activate and unlock incredible
sets. You're getting way ahead of yourself.
But I think for a lot of people,
you did not look at the notes, did you?
He didn't. But I think for a lot of people, the appeal of this game was 108 characters that are hard to find. Like, if you just play through this game,
Cervantes is a little tough to find.
I played this after Final Fantasy VII, after Final Fantasy Tactics, after Lunar's release.
No, I was about to congratulate you.
Lunar.
Victor Ireland would be so happy you just called it Lunar.
They kept calling it that on that damn making of. Anyways.
The A is bigger.
Lunar. So I played it after that and it's like Star Ocean Second Story.
So what did you think when you first played it?
I'm not a biggest fan as Shivam is, but I thought it was really awesome. Like it's not my favorite RPG of all time, but I stuck with it and I got all the characters. And I thought it was really cool. And I think it was because of that gimmick to it, the 108 characters.
I'm gonna reel this back to where I was going when
I thought we were all talking about our experiences with the game.
No, I don't know where that came from.
I think you asked about it.
I didn't. No.
Rewind the tape.
I was saying that this game – The original Suikoden was created as a prequel, as a prologue to the bigger game.
Which is cool to know.
This is something that I think makes the game really great. This is something – I don't know. Like I don't know if it was deliberate at the time, but you also saw this with Ark the Lad where you had this game that you can easily complete in like 15 hours.
It's like a test run.
And then the sequel is about 6 or 7 times that size. Ark the Lad 2 is huge.
But kind of the same thing, just blown
up. Very similar,
I'm going to contest your argument here, Jeremy, because we played through Suikoden 1 for US Gamer maybe 4 years ago, and it was like, oh, this will be a breezy, simple thing.
It's like 10 hours.
It's like 20 plus hours. Okay. Ark the Lad is like under 10.
Look, if I played Suikoden 1 right now with my eyes closed, I could beat it in 21 hours tops. With every character. Because the hard part is you get a little slowed down trying to get the mysterious pot. But otherwise
that mysterious pot.
That'll slow you down.
But otherwise,
have you tried the panhandle? That's usually where you get
kids, don't do the mysterious pot.
We're in California. Go to the mysterious pot store.
It's legal now.
The nameless urn. But Suikoden, you're right. It's smaller in scope than Suiko 2. It's smaller in every dimension, but it felt huge. Well,
okay. So that's the thing. That's where I was trying to go with this, but people keep interrupting. It is a very compact game. It's, you know, very much in the vein of a 16-bit RPG like Final Fantasy IV or Chrono Trigger, where you can complete a single playthrough in 15 to 20 hours. But despite the fact that it is a very brisk game, it doesn't feel small. Like you do manage to get that whole army building, 108 Stars of Destiny. You have multiple combat systems. Yep. You build a castle. Like it is this vast, sprawling epic that takes place across, you know, like an entire kingdom. And there's hints of a much larger world at work too. And all of this fits into this pretty small game. But I think a lot of that goes down to the technology. Like I said, you know, it feels in terms of scale similar to a 16-bit RPG. It also feels very similar in tech to a 16-bit RPG. And I think that's something that works a lot in Suikoden's favor. And even though the games took a lot of heat in the press at the time for being ugly or dated, the super low-tech look, you know, not having a ton of polygons really makes for a brisk game. You don't have tons of loading times. You don't have just the sort of inherent slowness of getting around in a 3D space. Everything is Okay, so being forced to move in cardinal directions is not great. Like that really dates it.
I mean, but the game was before the DualShock came out.
Right.
It was, but you could still do diagonals in Chrono Trigger.
Well, but most 16-bit enabled RPGs you can't. I mean, I think
this was 32-bit.
But I think if you look at this game, like what it launched with, you know, Suikoden 1, this structure of, you know, the 108 Stars of Destiny as like the premise and the idea of three different battle systems. You know, like the main core battle system, the dual system, the tactical battle system, plus the first one had a little bit fewer of like the kind of mini game kind of things, you know, the town building. It kind of presented these things that were really engaging that the player, as a player, I really, you know, immediately enjoyed. And then the second one just kind of blew all of that out with even more depth.
Absurdly.
Yeah. And I think that's what set it apart. And at the time, Suikoden 1 was kind of like the cult classic critical choice. And people would come into my GameStop asking for a role-playing game. This would be the one to recommend. They'd be like, I never heard of it. The art's kind of bad. I'm like, no, stick with it. It's good.
See, I enjoyed Suikoden 1.
Pre-FF7.
Before Final Fantasy VII, I played it. And then I played it again to get all 108 Stars of Destiny. But I didn't think that much of it. I was like, oh, this is a neat little standalone game. It wasn't until the sequel came out that I was like, oh, these are two parts of a really amazing whole.
I think people look back on the first one.
Suikoden 2 is a great, vast game on its own. But when you combine it with the first one, and they do combine, like they literally combine, go together.
You literally take the save file over. We'll get to that. But I think, you know, for Konami Computer Entertainment Tokyo to like make these two games as their first two, you know, PS1 role-playing games, like they really did bring something new to the table, you know, simultaneously with what Square Enix was doing. I think actually they should be respected for doing something important at the time.
If I may make a wild and outlandish premise for a second, I think Suikoden 1 is kind of one of the perfect templates of how to build out how to do world building in an RPG that is still compact, hit all your plot points without feeling cliche, without feeling like you're following the numbers. Because when you're playing that game, it's a linear game, but it doesn't feel linear. It feels
until you start saying no to the dialogue prompts,
right. And then you're like, oh, you're forced to say yes.
I'm being railroaded. Huh.
Yeah, but the thing is, though, the game gives you this wide open kind of feeling of this world, and it creates in a very small space a really deep breathing universe.
I do appreciate the fact that in the first game, there's like at least one opportunity to go off the rails early on and just do your own thing. Like very early, you're supposed to go to this one place, but you can go – I can't remember exactly. You go to like Rockville or something.
Yeah, you're supposed to go to Rockville, the tiny little town.
Right, but you can go off in another direction and you're way overmatched at first. Like the monsters will just like stomp you. But if you can survive, like you go fight one battle – then go back to an inn and save, another battle, and then you'll start leveling up really quickly, and then you can like you can get something.
Basically, what it is is there's this dungeon that's off the first town, and if you go there before you pick up any other partners, except for like you
it'll
solo,
be you and Ted, right?
Yeah, you solo or you and Ted. If you go solo by yourself, you get materia that gives you double experience. If you the rune, they give you double experience that will make you enhance your experience all the way. Or if you go,
you get through the dungeon and find a town, and a guy's like, "You came here by yourself?
Yeah, here.
Have this prize. You're awesome."
The other one is you get double money, and it's just such a reward for like sequence breaking because you're not supposed to go there for a long time still, and just the fact that they even thought that far was so clever.
It's funny. You bring up Ted. Reminds me of like even at the time, the weird inconsistencies of the names. Mm-hmm. Like they don't really match. Like some of them are like all archaic and medieval sounding. Other ones are Ted. It's very
– That's 90s Ted. Localization.
Yeah, when you have 120-something characters to name, you start to go to Ted after a while.
And another thing, you know, this is supposed to take place in a kingdom, but it really feels like you've got pretty much the entire world here. Right. You've got the fishing village that feels very like East Asian, and you've got Scarletica Castle that's very French. Then there's like a ninja town, and then there's also dwarves and elves, and
it feels very cosmopolitan.
does. Yeah. Does it? Well, it's a mishmash. Well, I'll say one of my issues with Suikoden back in the day was that, like, the story is good enough and I'm intrigued. I like most of the characters, but like there's something kind of separating me from really getting too involved with the characters. Like the story is a little more macro and it's like, you know, kind of warring factions and political intrigue and
– okay. For me, I guess it always just kind of resonated because it felt – it had the tenor of a Mahabharata or like a Hindu kind of like one of the old folk tales we have of like people getting caught up into this gigantic
– right. It does
you know,
have
deities fighting
well, I mean,
type of
it's
story.
Based on a classical Japanese or Chinese novel, right? Yeah, the Water Margin.
Right. Exactly. And the anime for Shigeyugi is also based off
of
that.
Right.
But the thing was it just had this kind of epic – that we get in like, you know, Hindu Buddha stories. And it had a whole kind of resonance that I had never seen in an RPG in America. Plus the sound designers did things like they integrated tablas and sitars into some of the songs.
Yeah.
They had like, you know, Japanese instrumentation. The towns kind of felt like their own little – yes, it was definitely a kitchen sink RPG. Yeah. It was definitely – let me see if I can make Asia and Europe and, you know, Elfland.
But it all fits.
But to me, it had a cohesion.
Yeah.
And it drew me in with that kind of like sensation that, oh, these people can exist in this world together, which is really hard to do. Like any D&D designer can tell you like, okay, well, how do I make Chinese Elfland work with Scottish dwarves? It doesn't always work.
Yeah, I feel like this game kind of had the same ambition of you know, world building and scale as the Evil East games, but they feel a lot more personable. I mean, I love Yasumi Matsuno's games and, you know, Final Fantasy Tactics, Vagrant Story, amazing. I love those. But they also feel – I don't even know about austere. They just feel very like – very formal. There's almost a kind of stuffiness to them.
There's not that here.
There's – well, I think it's part of, you know, like the tactical play in Final Fantasy Tactics. You never really directly control Ramza as it like just a character moving around, whereas here you control – Teo or, you know.
I think a lot of the evilest things happen off screen too where they're just like you're not involved with these big events, especially Final Fantasy XII. You're like at a distance from the big events in the story.
Right, whereas here you are sort of the chaotic fulcrum around which events spin whether you want to be or not. And that is kind of like the defining trait of the Suikoden games is that it's basically like this – almost like a pattern of history where someone is drawn into the conflict and, you know, sort of against their own desires or wishes, they become the focal point of this conflict and end up changing the world.
Yeah, and it just – it – I mean, you're right. Like Tactics in the other games feel kind of Rosencrantz and Guildenstern are dead as in like you are there. Things are happening but it's not you that it's happening to. In this one, when you're McDowell and you're running around and you're – fight and building a castle and everything, suddenly everything matters on what you are doing, who you are talking to. And it's absurd. It's like when you're in the position of this hero, because he's a silent protagonist, a lot of times silent protagonists are kind of bad. But in this case, I felt like, oh my God, he's not silent because they didn't write him. He's silent because he's so confused and terrified of this event that's happening. Like your father is suddenly like your enemy. What the hell is going on?
So I mentioned, you know, 16-bit systems again, and I do want to say maybe the most shocking thing about Suikoden is that for a long time there was a rumor that the series started out as a Super NES game, Super Famicom game.
I can't believe that.
I mean
– planning.
Yeah, like you can really kind of see that. Okay, sure. Like even the FMV at the beginning of the game, it's like – it's not pre-rendered characters or hand-drawn animation. It's like some static sprites. Images that are given a Photoshop effect. And then it's, you know, like actual just footage of the game, like the sprites walking
outside
around.
Aside from the music, there's nothing here that couldn't be done, really.
Yeah. But no, that was not the case. This was not meant to be a Super Famicom game. It was actually meant to be a like a keystone title for a console that Konami was developing.
Reading
they
this
were
in
going
the notes
to make
blew
their
my
own
mind.
Console. Like what would that even have been?
The 90s were crazy.
Can you imagine if Konami made a console? That's like the opposite of what Konami is now.
I could see that happening though. I mean the 90s, everybody was making a console.
Oh, sure. Oh my God, yeah. Dude. A console with exclusive DDR Castlevania and Suikoden? That would have just broken my – I mean I would have been a Konami stan forever. That's kind of just the end of that.
But for whatever reason, Konami decided maybe we won't do that. And it's probably – I'm going to guess because PlayStation came out – and was an amazing piece of kit that they could not have hoped to compete with. And unlike Sega, who was like, well, we can't compete with that, so let's put a second processor in there. That's going to solve everything. They just said, you know what?
let's just go with it.
Speaking of Sega,
we've been a third party. We'll just stay.
Speaking of Sega, did anybody ever play the Saturn version, which came out like 2 years later? And I think it's troubled, kind of like the Symphony of the Night.
Which is so weird because you'd think this game, this mostly sprite based 2D game, should be a home run for Sega Saturn.
I know.
But I don't think they put their A team on their Saturn conversions.
I don't think they put their E team on the Saturn conversions.
You know, I think thinking back to Sega 1, my favorite thing about it at the time and thinking back was the main battle system. And the reason why I loved the battle system in this game is it was fast, especially it loaded fast. If you go back to 1997, 1998 era PS1 games, most RPGs, well, you might as well go make a sandwich while the battles load.
Yep.
Sugoden 1, the battles load.
You got the mosaic effect. Right.
Dun, and wait for load. Every figure.
About the time you get to the second stanza, then the character models load.
And then you do, you know, Knights of the Round times 4 and then read a book and come back.
By comparison, these battles load pretty quickly. They run fast and they're kind of fun.
And you have like auto battle too, which is I use this game.
Yeah, you can auto battle. Or you could just pay the money and just walk away from
it. Oh, yeah, that too.
You could do that too.
But yeah, there's like a screen dissolve. And as soon as the screen dissolve ends,
you're in.
You are making commands. And if you choose auto battle on like just standard mobs,
just everyone just jumps in.
And the time it takes from the battle transition to begin to you tally up your experience points and potch. Then that is
the currency.
Is the amount of time it takes for the mosaic effect to begin and you to input your first command in Final Fantasy VII or Wild Arms.
So it has the best of both worlds. If you don't want to pay attention and just like level up, you can kind of put it on auto and plays itself. Or if you actually have hard battles, you know, there is tactical depth.
There's so much depth.
Yeah, where you position your characters. It's like it's a good battle system. It really is.
Are we okay to talk about the battle system?
I know, I kind of jumped ahead.
Let's see.
It's my favorite thing.
Because I totally have a lot to say about the battle system.
We'll jump ahead to combat mechanics. Yep.
Okay. So
we should mention that it's a turn-based battle system.
Yeah, so here's the thing, right? It's a turn-based battle system. You've got up to 6 characters and they stand
That's actually – that lot. Right there is worth mentioning because
it's a lot.
What other console game lets you – console RPG lets you control 6 characters in battle?
Very few. Like and 5 had been previously the high watermark, you know.
And
like,
not just forcing you to have 6. You could have up to 6.
Right.
I'm sorry, that was an era in which because of polygons, they're drawing back to 3.
Yeah, so everything like Final was going Fantasy back 7, to 3. You had like your 3.
Final Fantasy 9 went back to 4, and it was like the PlayStation 1, you could feel it melting as you played.
Yeah, but in this, you have 6 guys. There's a front row and a back row, so there's 2 rows of 3. And depending on where you put it, you could have different units doing joint actions together that would let, for instance... the hero would jump out and do its
The character positioning didn't make any difference for joint attacks.
Sometimes it did.
Very few. For the most part, your positioning was determined and on your weapon type. Because there were short, medium, and long range weapons.
I was thinking Suikoden 3, not Suikoden 1.
Okay.
In Suikoden 1, you're right. Your positioning was based on whether you had a short weapon where you're forced in the front, long in the back, medium, you could jump back and forth. That let you kind of customize the way your party worked, but also gave you inbuilt limitations so that you couldn't just, you know, try to game the system.
Right. But also it's worth noting that enemies also had rows.
Yeah.
So if you had a medium range character that you put in the back row, they could attack the enemy's front lines but not the back lines.
Exactly.
But if you put your medium range in the front row, you could attack the enemy's rear lines.
And it was smart because if you had a mage who had short range, you shoved him in the back row, yes, he can't attack, but also means the enemy can't directly jump to them.
Yeah, I mean it really goes back to games like Wizardry and like the sort of early dungeon crawlers, which you really don't see a lot of in this style of like post-Ultima, post-Dragon Quest RPG where it's not just like you're dungeon crawling, it's wireframes. So it's a really sort of interesting almost like not a backward facing, but it's like they really stopped and looked at the roots of the genre.
In the branches of like Japanese RPG development, instead of following the Dragon Quest path, they just went the wizardry route. But
But only for that one detail, really. Like, there's not a lot of wizardry in this game.
No, but that detail is so core to the kind of the idea of this combat system. And then your magic system was rune-based. You had different slots, so it was you could use, like, you know, 1, 5, 7 amount of spell slots to cast your spells. And it was really neat to see just kind of the different combinations you could build, because your max level spells could combine in a macro to do, like, you know, lightning fire damage or whatever. There weren't really summons in this game, which is good, because that was what ate the processor and everything else. But God, the combat was fast. It was furious. And
one of the things I really like about the combat system, when you talk about it being fast, and it's something that I just remembered, is that you have overlapping actions. Because
simultaneous actions.
Yeah, it's turn-based per side. So you input your entire party's commands and then execute. And sometimes your characters will act at the same time, not just as joint actions, but it's just everyone's jumping forward.
There's like a melee.
It's a satisfying feeling. I don't think I'd played a console game that had quite that same execution of like multiple people running into attack at the same time.
Right. And it doesn't like give you a tactical advantage or anything. It's not like
the game looks cool.
Yeah. It looks cool, but it also makes the battles go faster because it's not taking turns for each character to act out an attack.
And I feel like this wasn't accidental. I feel like they wanted these battles to feel fast and they really succeeded. That's something many people were doing back then.
Like, one of the cool things was if you had a character who had multiple attacks, for instance, in Sekiro 2, you got Shiro the wolf, and he would jump forward and bite one guy and then jump and bite another guy, and you would see, and it would make you feel like you're in a D&D combat or a melee where it's just like, oh, these guys are just attacking anything. It's not just regimented Revolutionary War rows walking forward.
And one of the things that I think is really overlooked about the battle system is the sound design of the battle system. We talked about the great music, and we'll talk more about the music. But the sound design, it's like they took a Saturday morning cartoon audio library, and there's like all these spell effects. Like, I could see Skeletor casting magic and it coming up with, you know, sound effects like this. It just has this really distinctive design that I've never heard in any other game series. But it doesn't make the game feel cartoonish. It just makes it really distinct. And I don't know, there's like lots of sound effects for things like your character's getting hit or missing an attack.
Yeah.
And it just like it's a very distinct soundscape. And when you start getting all these characters acting and their actions overlap and happen simultaneously, it just like creates this like pop, pop, pop sound effect.
It's interesting because I never looked to see who does the sound effects for any game ever. But, you know, like 4 or 5 composers worked on this game. And I'm curious like if the sound effects dudes were guys from Gradius or Castlevania. If like, you know,
I mean,
like,
they must have been, right? Like,
because, you know, Tappy's one of the composers on
Is he? You know, Konami doesn't credit individual composers.
No, they credit
it's always
like the
Konami Kokea Club.
Yeah.
There were 5 composers.
Like, I've done liner notes for LP releases of Konami games, and I've tried to cite individual composers that I know work on the game. They're like, it was Konami Kokea Club.
Wasn't this – this was like by Mari Yamane or something, right, who did the
Yamane did not contribute to this.
I don't think so, no.
But there were five composers. I know Tappy, who's one of the old school dudes, is among them.
But the point, though, you're right. Like when McDowell does his big rune of like destruction type of effect, it's got this kind of weird like sci-fi sound of like the world is kind of spinning going
downwards.
It's
like the D&D cartoon, like the Dungeon Master casts a portal or something. Like that's the sound effect you would hear.
And that's like
it's really great sound design.
The one 32-bit effect of the ground just twisting as it's kind of going down.
Well, you know, even though I said this game looks like 16-bit, the battle system still does have sort of a 3D element to it.
There are some effects,
and so it takes place on like a plane. The battle system viewpoint is very similar to Breath of Fire, but it feels more fluid,
right?
And
but
it feels
the
more
ground
dynamic.
Is actually a polygon.
Yeah, the ground is a polygon, and it means the camera can zoom in. Like sometimes you'll get like a super powerful attack or something, and the camera will really come in close, and your sprites will scale up, and it just like. It's all very dynamic and fast-paced. That's one of the things that really sells this game. And it's one of the reasons I could not get into Suikoden 3 because it cut the combat group in half.
Among other
and
problems.
And made everything so slow. And I was
very
like,
slow game.
It lost all the things I love about
Suikoden. I like
Suikoden.
The ducks.
The ducks were cool, but the problem
was – there were no squirrels.
It took out all of the interest – I mean 3D polygons. That just changed the entire
game. The character models are like – inexcusable in Suikoden 3.
I don't care how ugly they look. It's just it changed the pace and the nature of the battle system. And that to me, that really killed the experience because just like blasting through battles and not having to worry about slowdown and everything.
Let's not taint the legacy by talking about things past 2. Let's just enjoy Suikoden 1 and 2 for what they are.
The thing is, though, like, just the balance of combat, attacking, and like magic in this game, it's very simplistic. It's almost like Phantasy Star 4, kind of like very base, like.
But it never gets old. Much like, you know, actually, Phantasy Star 4 has really fast, fun auto battles too. And I think it's a similar comparison where, like, I was never running away from combat in Suikoden 1 because I was bored of it. It was fun. It was fast. It resolved itself quickly. I was raising levels.
And all of the character animations were great.
Right. And
108 of them.
I think we're going to jump to like the other two battle systems.
We'll talk about that later.
Okay. Because like they do mix it up. It's not the only thing you're doing.
Right. I think we can't talk about the battle system without talking about first the fact that we mentioned short, medium, long range attacks. Those are separate character. And there's a reason for that. It's because your character has one weapon. Yes. You don't buy weapons in this game. You do not change up weapons. It's not just that you're restricted to one weapon type. You are restricted to a weapon.
Your character named weapon.
Yeah, your character has – like your main character has a staff in the first game. There's like dudes with swords. There's dudes with knives, like throwing darts, whatever, pole darts, pole arms. It's always the same. Like they have that one weapon and they carry it through with them. And to make your weapon stronger, you go to blacksmiths.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And the blacksmith can rework your weapon into a stronger form. And once it reaches like a certain level, then you get little plus marks on it.
And the name changes.
Yeah.
And it felt like that was one of the details that I absolutely loved because it was – first off, it was a good game design limitation. You can't make your weapon too powerful for the area you're in because you can't get the next blacksmith for X amount of time. But because it's a one named weapon per thing, it made every character feel like a real hero, like a real a figure of legend, a figure of destiny even. And it had this whole feeling that like, oh, there's the man with the tiger sword. He's famous for having that tiger sword. And then it becomes a puma sword. And then it becomes the mountain lion sword.
Right. Well, and some characters like, you know, there's a couple of characters who named their swords after the woman
like
they love.
Flick, right?
Yeah,
he's got the Odessa.
He's got the Odessa. And then there's the other kid in the warrior village.
Yeah.
I don't remember his name.
I think it was out of necessity for Konami. One, because they didn't want to draw a million sprites for each possible weapon use.
Sure.
But also because for the player, you don't want to have to be juggling weapons between 108 characters or, you know, less if you're not going
to
use all of them.
A lot of inventory to keep up with.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah.
But it still, I think, is a really cool design choice just in terms of like – how the game mechanics sort of tell the story and what you can infer from different characters based on the weapon they use and what they name their weapon. It's a really cool little detail.
And it felt like of the story that they were trying to tell, the Chinese legend of like, you know, like the ancient soldier who's got his famous set of nunchucks and it's like, oh, it
further defines everything.
Right. Like, again, just coming from Hindu mythology, when you've got, like, you know, Arjun with his Indraprastha bow, and you're like, this is a hero with his weapon of legend, it felt more real than just like, oh, look, he's got the broadsword plus two this time and a broadsword plus seven.
Like, as you start amassing these characters, there are some very specialized characters. Like, oh, the girl who can teleport people or whatever. And like, you know, some of these are
Not all 108 characters that you
recruit are combat characters.
Are for combat.
Right. Some
it's
of
like
them are
40
for your
per game.
Yeah, some are for your town to do cool things in your town.
Yeah, there's like the lady who does laundry. She's I can't do much for combat, but I can wash clothes. Or there's Klon, who's just like,
welcome
to the name of your castle. I feel so good.
Can we talk about the town aspect? Because I think that's what drew me to the
definitely,
entire game.
But I want to wrap up combat by talking about combo attacks.
Yes.
Which is another detail that is really great. You kind of touched on that earlier, but I think it's worth mentioning that you know, this isn't like say Chrono Trigger where every character has multiple combination attacks with every other character. It's more that certain characters have combo attacks, like team attacks,
combat attacks
with certain other characters. And again, like this is the story influencing the game mechanics and vice versa. Like if two characters have a relationship of some sort in the story, they probably have some sort of team attack. And it does kind of determine how you build your party because it makes sense to keep characters who, you know, they have a relationship and therefore can, you know, be more effective in combat together. Like you could put like Flick with Tyr's master, but why would you do that? You could, you know,
but
you could have put a blacksmith with you know, Yamku or something, but why would you do that? Like they don't team up. But if you put five blacksmiths together,
they all jump
in
out
your
with
party,
hammers.
They destroy everything in a crazy attack.
And
but then again,
McDole and his master have a double staff attack. Mm-hmm. The two pirate – I mean, like if you have the pirate battalion that you get together, they all have a massive pirate attack.
Is this martial artist. Which game is the squirrels? Is the second one?
That's the second one.
Five squirrels.
Where they all just go boom, boom, boom,
yeah, the squirrels basically take the place of the blacksmiths in the first game.
I just – and one of the joys for me was finding out these different unifications. These, and the thing is because each of the team attacks told their own story. Mm-hmm. Like they were like, oh, look at the old men who have known each other for 100 years just hanging out, going and slapping you with their little staff. Or
you know, like the retinue that McDowell starts the game with,
Cleo
and Pon and Gremio. Gremio. Like they can all team up for attacks.
It's like the medallion unification. But it was so cool. And like you'd have all the elves together. They'd all stand up and shoot with their bow, go thunk, thunk, thunk. And it just –
it really was those little touches. You're right.
And there was so much extra animation dedicated to each of these. Like you might never see all of them and there's still just like some combination sprite out there that's just cool looking.
It's funny. The first game felt slight, but in hindsight, like it's rich and deep for like not being, you know,
they
longest
shoved
game.
As much as they possibly could in that game.
Yeah. Yeah. Are there any characters that you always have to have in your party for Suikoden 1?
I use Gremio a lot, actually.
For most of the game. Yeah. For some of the game.
Well, let's see. I loved Cleo, but my team was always like McDowell, Flick, Victor, and then I would have one of the ninjas, probably Edge, because he was good at carrying runes and also had the long range attack. And then I would have God, who the hell is the old guy? Crowley, the mage, and it depends. Probably Stallion because I wanted to run.
Oh yeah, he's a good one to have. I always had Kasumi because she's a cute ninja and that's cool. And crap, what's the name of the kid? Damn it.
Oh, I would use
totally
the
forgot.
Kid.
Yeah,
the kid. Hugo.
Oh, Clive. Clive was always in my party because he's got a rifle.
Yes, Clive is good. I would use him a lot. But no, there's – damn it. I can't remember the name of the person that I was always having in my party. But
I like Flick.
Flick is cool.
He reminds me of Locke.
Yes.
He's kind of identical to Locke in terms of his character design. I think that's why I like
Rogue.
God, I loved all – I mean every time I played the game, I tried to pick a different host of characters just to try to like mix it up and see how to beat the game. But it's just fun.
Wasn't there an attack where like if you put all the Imperial generals you recruit, they can like team up and do some crazy
with,
Imperial attack?
With Sonya Shulin and like all of them. Yeah, they could get together and do this big just like hit you with my armor nonsense.
Yeah, like it's really fun that just the way you build your party sometimes unlocks different abilities that you wouldn't expect.
Yeah. Oh man, this game is so good. I love Suikoden so much. Oh my god.
All right, so Bob, you wanted to talk about building a town, building a castle.
In fact, it's one of my favorite systems in a game. And I think that's why I like this game so much, not just for the characters you recruit, but for the fact that when you recruit them, they live in your castle and they build your castle up from like a squalid hellhole into a nicer place to live.
Yeah, and, I mean, when you first encounter the castle that you take over, it is like a haunted island in the middle of a dead lake and no one wants to go there.
Ice dragon.
Is this the first JRPG to do this?
So this came out at the same time as Breath of Fire 2, which had the fairy town.
Yeah,
which is a little this is a little different.
It's better.
Wasn't there in the Dragon Quest in the Super Nintendo Dragon Quest? Didn't you have the ability to build your town
in 5 or 6? I never.
I thought. Or was that in the Game Boy remakes?
I feel like this was my first encounter.
I think that
was certainly my first.
I think that was a DS remake thing.
Yeah, I mean, I love these systems because I like the idea of like having an effect on the game world. And some of my favorite games do this, like the two Metal Gear games where you build a base are my favorites. And the Souls games do this. You rescue people in the world and then they sort of build up a settlement. But also there is a game I feel that's very inspired by Suikoden. It's Radiata Stories or Radiata Stories. I don't know if it's very good. I played through it all when I was incredibly depressed. But it has 180 characters you can recruit and put them all in your party. And the entire game is built around like all these characters have schedules, learn them all, and you cannot get them all in one playthrough. So this is a tri-ace game, so it's kind of weird and not – I mean it's not completely – it's very janky, but I remember enjoying it while being incredibly depressed. So that's not a stunning endorsement, but I don't know if anyone else has played that. But that's one of those games where it's like,
yes, I meant to, but I didn't.
I can recruit 1,000 people.
It's on my shelf. Is that a PS3 game?
PS2.
Not to be mistaken for Radiant Historia.
Yeah.
Oh, that's what I was thinking of.
Also not that good.
But the thing about Tsukuden's town system is that it would – like again, it added to the milieu of the game, right? Like you're a roving army. You're trying to build up an army to fight against the evil empire to take them over, which means you need to go recruiting people to get into your town. And some people won't join you unless they've seen that you've got enough people on your team, because they're like, I'm not going to join a losing side of nobody's.
Yeah.
And some people are just like, hey, yo, dude, I'm a merchant and I've got nowhere to go. Can you? And you're like, oh, you know, I've got this perfect stall I've just built in my basement that you could totally tell me things.
And then there's like someone who's just like, I like to say the names of places. Can I hang out at your place and say its name? And it just, I love that kid. He's so useless.
I did just think, I guess it does owe a debt to Shining Force. Shining Force 1 and 2, especially 2, you have like the granary role around with the people in it. Like when you recruit people in Shining Force, they would come and hang out and you talk to them. So it does – it owes that to Shining Force.
My favorite thing in this game is when you recruit the guy that has the dice game, you basically just keep saving and reloading until you keep winning to have infinite money. And no one needed to tell me that. I'm just like, oh, I'll cheat.
Well, see, that's it. That's the guy I always have on my team is Sansuke.
Really?
The bath guy with the saw? Who runs the furo. Like my favorite thing about the bath is that if you put the like 6 hex dolls as decorations in there, you get a crazy cursed evil bath.
Right.
If you put a peeing statue in the corner, it pees on the head of your main character.
And I just like coming back to the town, especially once you get deeper in the game and it's getting good. Because at the beginning, there's no one there. But like as it starts to really flesh out,
it feels like a real city.
And you have ownership. It's fun to hang out there.
I mean, that's the thing. It felt like progression. Like you're like, oh, we're making something. We're going to do something. And it just had this it just gave you this vibe of like this game is more than just fighting.
Right. And also having a castle created a safe space. And that's something that I enjoyed in Final Fantasy VIII, where you had the
garden.
Yeah, the garden that was flying around and that was like your base of operations. But here it was really like there's a space that you can go back to between missions. You don't have to go hang out in some town. You're not always itinerant, wandering from place to place. You have a home. And also I think the game subverts that once or twice by kind of thrusting events upon you. You're back at the castle. And you go to sleep and, you know, you're ready to take on the next, you know, mission or, you know, go on in a foray. And all of a sudden people are attacking you. And you're like, wait a minute, I'm not ready for this. And you have to prepare at the last second. So it really creates this newfound sense of tension.
Yeah.
And it's a really – like the way they make use of the town mechanic I think is really smart because it does – it puts you in the mindset of like, hey, I'm really building an army. Like I'm always seeing these people – They're you know,
and when you
creating
see them,
a town around
and
me.
When you see them in the town, they're logically laid out the way an army would be. Like, you're like warehouse person, the quartermaster, the boats, the navy. Like,
yeah, there's like the top floor is the command,
the
team,
scientists
basically.
At the bottom, the tacticians, and then you've got your like stores, and it was just neat to have your own perma base you could always go back to. Anything you bought anywhere in the world would end up in one of your stores, so you could go back if you missed something. And then like the gambling guys, like the cups that I memorized so that I could see the first thing you moved and then I just know which pattern you're on to.
Another game that does this very well is Brave Fencer Musashi. I was just remembering because I love any game that does this, and that game does it incredibly well. You rescue people from the kingdom and you build the kingdom and they give you things and teach you moves and things like that. I love games that do this.
So I guess the other big thing to talk about are the other battle systems, because in addition to the standard combat system – yes. There's also the tactical system and the duel system, and that seems to be Shane's jam.
Well,
so Shane,
it's funny. I don't feel like these are as strong in the first game.
No,
they're definitely.
But they were cool.
They're a way
to mix things up and tell a story in a different way.
They were unexpected, and I think this is again pre FF7. So like the idea of like inserting all these different gameplay styles into a JRPG was very refreshing. And at the time, I remember the duel in particular. I felt like
so good.
But I felt like it was inspired by Romance of the Three Kingdoms games, which had duels. And it was
going to Shining Force or Fire Emblem.
Or Fire Emblem.
You have those like the individual actions kind of play out as duels. But here, like, that was the battle. You had to choose your action.
But it also draws back to the source material of Water Margin, where you got the heroes who have to have the epic duel against the other general, or the, and the one-on-one fighting that just comes from Japanese culture of, like, you know, the two soldiers are going to get in the field and they're going to have that.
Yeah. And it's presented in this very dramatic fashion.
The very visuals. Harsh angle that's and it spins around when you declare your attack.
Yeah. But a great thing is that it's not like just a total – like the army battles are pretty much rock, paper, scissors.
Right.
Like choose the right command and you'll stomp the other army, like, I feel like mess up. And
like,
you'll,
yeah, the tactical – the army battles are a little too simple.
Those are mostly
– they're for the flavor.
They're heavily story-based. Like there are some battles you just can't win. So it's like to basically say, oh, we just lost 1,000 people. I guess we got to go figure out how to get the fire spear.
Right. And there aren't very many of them, but I found myself, even on the initial playthrough, like not looking forward to those so much.
Yeah. But they're pretty quick and easy and painless.
Right.
Although you can permanently lose characters from your army in those battles.
Yeah, only for
like
bad.
If you screw up really badly, though, you will lose a team member. It's like someone you've recruited will be gone forever.
Yeah.
And they'll be like, sorry, that's it. That's
true. But I remember I found these refreshing because like it was unexpected to have a different type of conflict.
But the duels are great because the outcome of those duels is not determined by the story and it can in fact change the story. But there is an element of story to them because they are sort of like the big pivotal moments in the game. But if you pay attention to what your opponent says – It hints at what they're going – like the action they're going to take.
Like I love that this game basically had one-on-one fighting without forcing you to do dexterity, right? Like it's all still text-based. It's all still turn-based. But you just have to know the characters. You have to understand the motivation of this fight. Why is he fighting you?
Mm-hmm.
What is he saying? What does that mean for – in terms of what you should be doing?
Right.
Like the battle that McDowell has against Pon, his number one associate, you can – if you
fight – When you say McDowell, you mean General McDowell.
No, I mean there's no well, – yeah. When Pon is fighting against General McDowell,
right?
Like if you just play through it normally, Pon would just pass away. He's way outmatched. He's going to get just crushed and then the game is just going to proceed. But once you play through it and you're like, oh wait, I need to get all 108 to do a thing in the end of the game, then you have to figure out how do I make Pon win this unwinnable battle? And that becomes its own kind of just like separate like mini game that you just have to keep in your head to try to understand this incredibly difficult battle.
Right, and you can win that battle, and you have to in order to be able to get all 108 stars of destiny at the end of the game and keep them alive. And if you do win that battle, like Pon is exhausted, and he's like, "Did he let me win?" Like even if you win that, like the game kind of says, like you weren't supposed to be able to do that, but you did anyway. But the one-on-one battles are a critical part of the story, especially where the protagonist is concerned when he is in the battles on his own. Usually that has to do with – not usually, but occasionally it kind of builds into the main story, which is that he has the Soul Eater and in order to power that up, he has to kill someone. And the kind of like the big watershed moment of the game is when he goes face-to-face against his father, which is the moment you knew was coming and you weren't sure how it was going to go. But it turns out, there's only one way it can go.
And it – God, this game – all of the Suikoden games are so good at forcing these like tension points where you're like, okay, look, there's only one way I can do it and it's going to just crush me to have to do this. But
that's kind of one of the big themes of Suikoden is that war is thrust upon people and thrust them into situations they don't want to be in. I think that especially comes through in Suikoden 2.
Yes.
We'll talk about that after the break. I think we need to pause for a moment. So we talked a lot about Suikoden 1, and a lot of the things we've said transfer over pretty cleanly to Suikoden 2.
I will say setting the stage, however, because I like to set
including
the stage.
Your save file.
I would like to set the stage. Between the release of Suikoden 1 and the release of Suikoden 2 in America, a very big thing happened called Final Fantasy VII. Yeah,
people started caring about role-playing games.
Right.
And the RPG explosion in America.
But what they expected, with the guys who got on the bandwagon for the giant comet coming down to Midgar, were not necessarily excited when they saw the graphics of a Suikoden 2 because their idea of role-playing games was Final Fantasy VII.
It's like, where's the summons?
Where are the polygons?
I need some FMVs.
It was also in the splash zone of Final Fantasy VIII. Right.
It was
right.
released within the same month as Final Fantasy VIII.
So I'll say when it came out, despite getting great reviews and now being revered as the greatest entry in the series, if not secretly the best RPG on PlayStation 1, it was a quiet launch. It was hard to find. It didn't sell out. I remember trying to sell it to people. So the mythology of Suikoden 2 grew over the years.
And it doesn't help that the first printing of Suikoden 2 that came out had like game-ending bugs in it. Like,
did they ever fix those?
In subsequent printings, I think, because I know
there were subsequent printings.
Well,
I think there were.
There had to have been because the only way I beat the game was by downloading an illegal ROM of it and making a hacked CD.
I believe he's right. Back then, they wouldn't say that a game was being patched in a subsequent pressing, but that kind of thing did happen.
So I didn't get any game-ending bugs in my launch day copy of Suikoden 2, but there were definitely bugs. Definitely places where they were like, localized text? What's that?
Oh, hey, we totally forgot this village existed.
Wait, could you get to Japanese text in Suikoden 2?
It wasn't – it was like Unicode, so it didn't – like they took out, I think, the Japanese actual alphabet from the game code. So what you got was like the data calls and stuff. So it's just like nonsense. It's like squares. Like,
it's all like brackets and nonsense.
Yeah.
And it's crazy because there was a scene where you're in the university town in the big tree. Flick goes into a building. He's supposed to come out and you're supposed to be able to progress the story. He never comes out and every named NPC in the world disappears.
Oh.
So that was
Yikes. Actually, okay. There was – I did come across a bug where it's in Tinto.
Yeah.
And like I – actually walked outside the boundaries of the world. I was like inside a building and I walked out and instead of transitioning to the outer town area map, I just like kept walking around and there was – I saw how the map for the town was laid out. Like the internal rooms were all arranged in data.
There's
so I could like
very famous...
walk around and see like, oh, hey, here's the basement from this other building.
Hey, you modern gamers who complain about seemingly endless patch and title updates, it's good maybe to be able to fix games in real time.
There's a very famous bug in Suikoden 2 where the gates of Tinto, when you're up there – the doors close on you. If you walk slowly inch by inch forward, you can actually cross through and skip a good chunk of it and like keep your party and get like just sequence break the game.
Sounds like Secret of Mana.
And yeah, very similar.
Of course, the famous NPC who you pick up who's a singer, who's supposed to sing your song and spends
five minutes of silence.
5 minutes of silence while her animation does a two animation cycle of looking like a gapping fish.
Her name is John Cage.
Okay, before these guys make you think it's a broken –
it's one of the greatest games of all time.
It's actually a great game. And it is a direct continuation of the first game in many ways.
Mm-hmm.
Back then you couldn't always assume a sequel was going to be that.
And now it's freely available for PS3 and Vita for download, right?
Well, not freely, but for like $5.99.
Yes, but that is sort of a miracle. For as much as we slag on Konami for doing horrible things with their IP, they're also very dedicated to selling you their old games. A lot of companies aren't. Like they make a lot of their stuff available.
It is funny, and I normally don't talk about my work when I'm on here because this usually doesn't. What I do nowadays doesn't really talk about these old games. When I first got to Sony, Suikoden 2 was not on PS1 Classics. And I went to the guy who does Konami account management and I was like, whatever it takes, you need to ask those people to put Suikoden 2 on PS1 Classics. Like, please. And it took for 2 years. I was like,
oh my God.
I was like, have you asked him about that? I'm like, it's a really good game. And
the day that you announced that it was coming,
it took
I got 50 messages on different social media. It's it's here.
I can't go too deep in. It was a long time ago, but the bugs were actually a concern, I think. And I think that was part of why it took so long.
You need to personally put it on PS4 though.
If only I could wave a magic wand.
And all the other classics and also all the PS2 games and PS3.
Shane, have you ever gotten the story on why Suikoden 1 and 2 for PSP never came to the US?
It's a good
– because they remade the games for PSP.
And they're beautiful.
And I think they didn't just – it wasn't just the like loading, the PS1 ROMs.
The loading times
They actually reworked all the graphics so it took full screen.
But the loading times aren't great, I know, on them. And then I wonder if that's one of the concerns.
Was there some sort of
– Suikoden with loading times?
I know, right?
Was there some sort of strange across-the-board rule about ports for a bit on PSP? Until Parappa came along?
No. I mean, it's – but, you know, one thing that often you know, users in the inner world don't understand that any third-party game, like as much as like someone who works at Sony might want to go to Konami and be like, hey, you have this cool thing that like you might want to think about. It's like totally up to the publisher. Like anything that happens with Suikoden is ultimately up to Konami. Like any platform holder or any outsider could be like, hey, you should think about this, but like – it's up to them.
I mean, they are responsible for Suikoden Tear Crease. So clearly they can't be.
Is that
that's
PSP
the
PSP one? What's the PSP one? Gensou Suikoden weirdo spinoff thingy?
Oh, that one didn't even come to the
US. The last Suikoden title. Yeah.
Yeah. Unfortunately, I don't remember. Murayama left the.
He like had the breakdown and left, and then
we had a breakdown.
Maybe I don't know if he had a. I mean, that was a rumor. Maybe it's just a. Like conflating the story with the FF12
guy. It could just be that Konami's not a great place to work.
That could be, but it just broke my heart.
Well, but do all of us agree that this is the end all be all? This is like everything they did in the first one times four, at least times magnitude of four.
I mean, yeah, this is kind of what you want from a sequel. Like take the good ideas and just explode them. It's a much larger game, but it doesn't feel unwieldy. Like it's, you know, a 50, 60 hour game.
Yeah.
And it doesn't overstay its welcome.
But my God, is it good. It's just like – okay. So first off, every art asset was upgraded. All the sprites
– the art looks way better.
All the portraits are just clean.
Also, you can run.
You can run by default.
That's a big deal. You can run.
The battles are the same, but now you can
they look better.
Equip three runes instead of just one.
And they look better. Everything looks better.
Oh, everything looks better.
Yeah, the background art is really nice. Like people – I mean critics really slagged on this game at the time of its release because, oh, it's too so ugly. But like if you stop and just pay attention to –
it's good animation.
You know,
in the
just like a you know a warehouse or something. Just the sprite art in each of these areas is so detailed and has such great use of color. Like they, one of the reasons I say that, you know, the first game looks 16-bit is because it looks 16-bit.
A little drab.
It doesn't really take advantage of the PlayStation's color palette or the
oh my god,
the
sepia tones that they use in Suiko 2 for like story events or elements just. It's so resonant.
This game has the best sprite work on PS1 in terms of storytelling outside of Final Fantasy Tactics.
I also think there's a more cohesive art style, and we were talking during the break, but it's very charming in the first game, but a lot of the art, especially the character portrait art, is very amateurish.
Yeah.
And not like a sixth grader drew, but still it feels like it could be better.
High school.
Kind of dojin.
Well, it feels
– yeah, dojin.
Has, dojin, exactly.
It has a very sort of like sketchy water pastel feel to it, whereas in Suikoden 2, it's more concrete and, you know, like
anime.
Everything is more
the black
fully
lines,
shaped.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's like manga versus anime.
Yeah. That's exactly what it feels like. But the thing about Suikoden 2, like for instance, in one of the early scenes, your main character's sister and the squirrel are running and having this big battle against like a bunch of random people who are invading your house in a flashback. And it's just this long, 5-minute long, like – fully animated sprite sequence of her just hitting people with flower pots and doing swinging her arms and legs and doing all these kung fu motions. And it's incredibly – like it's that like 10 seconds might be one of the best uses of sprite art in that era of gaming, just hands down. It's like so detailed, so thorough, and it's only used once ever.
So the first Suikoden tells a big story. You are the son of an imperial general. It's a time of peace. But there's corruption within the empire, and ultimately you end up sort of rooting that out by becoming involved with a rebellion, sort of being drawn into it against your will just by circumstance, becoming the holder of this legendary rune. We haven't talked about the runes, but we should. You know, eventually leading a resistance army that puts you in conflict with your own father who ends up dying in your – you know, kind of as a side effect of all of this. And you know, some of your close personal friends also die. Your best friend Ted, and what is Gremio to McDole? He's like
Gremio's like a combination nurse, bodyguard, older brother.
Yeah, he's
type.
Like an older brother who's not related by blood,
like
but is also
attendant
like
kind
he's
of?
Like he's like a helicopter mom.
He's like your auntie in like the kind of
yeah, like, it's, like assigned him.
Kind yeah.
Of. Like, and he makes a lot of stew. It's like it's a strange sort of relationship they have. But I guess, you know, the idea is that you are like the scion of a very important general.
He's
and therefore
he's
you
like
need
Batman's
to be,
Alfred.
Yeah, actually kind of like a personal butler.
That's
about,
exactly it.
Yeah.
I mean, again, though, it resonates back to the like East Asian story style of like, of course, the son of the noble is going to have a personal person who's been appointed since childhood to raise you because your father is too busy and your mother is dead. So like, you know, that's but he's just like there and mm-hmm. he's like part of your retinue.
But anyway, like a lot of these people who are close to you end up dying and there are some pretty sad moments. But none of these really hit with the same impact as events in Suikoden 2.
No.
Suikoden 2 takes advantage of its larger scale and longer running time to slow down occasionally and let the story – let you really soak in the story. You know, the sort of the intro, the first few chapters of the game, the protagonist, Ryo, and his like not blood brother but you know yeah. sort of
best
adopted
friend.
Brother, Joey – like you don't know that they're going to end up becoming enemies.
Okay, this also we start with the spelling of Joey. It's a problem.
It's J-O-W-Y. Inconsistent.
So like because of the weird spelling, J O W Y. Like my friends had called him like Jowie, and it was like I always hated him because I hated his name.
It's inconsistent. That's not really important though. What I was saying was that you know like the two of you and their adopted sister Nanami, like they're really close to each other. And there are some moments in the early parts of the game that really allow you to get a sense of their bond. And
it's
the moment
scope.
Where you're the moment where I think it's Nami and the little girl Pilika are waiting outside the town gates for Joey and Ryo to return. And it's just like this kind of drawn out moment of anxiety, and you get to kind of witness this. And when they finally get back together, like it's a genuine release. Like you're really happy for the characters.
God, that feeling. So like Nanami and Pilika are standing there, and it's like the town is like kind of burning, or there's like that haze in the distance, and you can just feel the nervousness, the anxiety, the fear that they have in a way that it's like video games didn't really do. RPGs weren't written like that.
Right.
And you just – like it just hit you. And like Pilika, the fact that she was mute and it's just like oh.
Because of trauma.
Yeah, like because of trauma.
Yeah,
because
she was so like, distressed to see her like, what, her family die?
Yeah, her family died and her town got totally torched. Mm-hmm. And it's just like that happens in real life. That's PTSD. That's like – it was just resonant and like – it made you just think about things that a 16-year-old generally doesn't spend time thinking
about.
It's
been almost 20 years since I played through this game, and I still remember these moments. Like the sort of – not like credit scene at the beginning where it's just showing you flashbacks to Joey and Ryo and Nanami's their childhood and their upbringing and the moments they shared together, training together and goofing around and fighting with each other. Like it's really like sweet. Those little moments are sort of the sort of – wordless storytelling that animation can do so well in things like Up or, you know, a few other occasional works you come across where you're like this really like wordlessly cements the fact that these are, you know, characters who are really important to each other and it gives you this insight into their lives just with these little flashes. And the fact that they took the time to do that in this game, this huge game about war and conflict and about kingdoms fighting and about this madman who is magically empowered and just wanted to kill everyone.
Most sadistic villain of all time.
But at the same time, there's this heart to the game, this central core of these characters who really love each other and their lives are about to be torn apart and everything is about to be turned upside down because of this war. They're the essence of it. Like this is what it's really about. No matter how big the story gets, it's still really about these three characters.
It makes you that like those 5 minutes or so of the beginning with the sepia tones and everything. It lays this kind of foundation that makes every event of the game just that much stronger. Like when these like when the hero and Joey get their runes, hero gets a bright shield, but. Joey gets the black sword and just the implications there and the fact that they then split paths and Joey turns to you and you have that conversation and it matters. You're like, oh my God, these two best friends who've lived their whole lives together are like now just this – you can feel something has been severed and it just resonated. It just made you want to know what happens.
Well, I love the fact that the protagonist of Suikoden 2, the magical rune he gets, is a protective rune. Because, you know, the protagonist of Suikoden 1 gets the Soul Eater, which is incredibly powerful, incredibly destructive, can like, you know, the first time you see it in action, it destroys a boss in a single action. And, you know, it kills people to empower itself. Whereas the Bright Shield, like, it turns the protagonist into a healer. It turns him into someone who creates, like, yeah, not just tanks, but, like, he can buff the party and he can heal the party. And it puts a completely different spin on the combat tactics. Like, he's no longer your heavy hitter. Like, he's tough. He can hold himself in action. But you don't have to necessarily put another healer in your party because you've got this guy who has, like, one of the 27 true runes that's about healing and making things better.
Yeah, and it really does change the tenor of the game too, because now you're like, oh wait, my hero is like not just this, you know, cold killer. Now he's like this caretaker kind of. He's got this, and it just changes the way you approach the game. Even though it doesn't really have a tangible effect on how you play, it still mentally colors everything you do.
I like how some of the sort of subtle choices or smaller design decisions in Suikoden 2 play off your expectations of the first game. In the first game, you're constantly given – or not constantly but regularly given these opportunities to make choices, like dialogue choices, but you can't. If you choose the wrong answer, you're railroaded, like, you know, the bandits try to give you drugged tea and everyone else is like, oh, it's bitter. So they're saying, hey, how come you haven't had your tea? Oh, I don't want any if it's bitter. And you can say that over and over again, but no matter how many times you say it, eventually you
drink
have to choose yes. Like, drink the damn tea. So you drink the tea. In this game, you get these opportunities to make these dialogue choices, and sometimes they actually do matter. And if you choose the wrong answer just to get the laugh, all of a sudden, like, things spiral out of control. Like, in
Hello,
Tinto
bad ending.
Yeah, in Tinto especially, you have the opportunity. Like, Nanami turns to the protagonist and says, I don't want to be caught up in this war. Why do we have to be involved in this? Let's run away. Let's just the two of us run away together and go live in peace. And if you're like, okay, let's do that, you don't think you're going to be able to do it, but you can.
It
turns into, like, a non-standard ending where – you go off and actually, I don't think it's an ending, is it? It's like you run away, but they track you down. Matthew tracks you down.
Bring you back.
But like, the thing is, in the process of doing this, like the party that goes out to find you, one of the key characters, the General Ridley, gets killed.
Oh, wow.
Like your
so it's
action,
like a punishment for
your action causes one of your party members, like an important party member, to die. And his Star of Destiny is eventually taken over by someone else, like his son, I think. But it's like,
just the fact that,
whoa,
that is an option, right?
You screwed up. You ran away from your obligations and someone died.
Right. And I mean, that just – this game had that whole tenor of like it definitely made you think about what you're doing in a way that RPGs used to not make you do. Like your actions matter in Suikoden. You – whatever you are doing is not just like, oh, I just – you know, looting your house or something. No, this stuff carries weight, and that was just mind-blowing.
So, you know, after the first game, okay, in the first game, the protagonist's nursemaid or whatever, Gremio, is killed like midway through the game. And it's,
spoiler alert.
It's an amazing sacrifice.
It's a good scene.
It's a good scene. It's a little bit overwrought, like when he's like, oh, the spores are eating me,
you
I'm
blind.
You can
kind of see it coming too.
It's a little weird. Like maybe it's just the way it was localized. But I kind of had a feeling something like that was going to happen in Suikoden 2. So I kept waiting the whole time, like, what's going to happen? Who's going to die? And it doesn't happen the way I expected. Like I thought it was going to be this unavoidable plot event. But instead, it happens suddenly like a thunderclap. All of a sudden, you're ambushed and there is a timed dialogue event where if you choose it just right, like if you respond and if you don't know it's coming, you won't know like, oh, I need to choose the other option right away. You're given like 2 seconds to read this dialogue and choose the option.
Is the correct one like the inobvious one? It's been a while.
I can't remember exactly, okay, but you have to like change the selection and activate it. Otherwise, Nanami dies. And it's just like, what the hell? Like at the time, I didn't realize it was something I could change.
It just seems so random. And
but then,
senseless.
You know, like once I beat the game and Nanami didn't come back, I was like, huh.
And it wasn't,
wow, okay.
It wasn't
so,
like
so
telegraphed. It wasn't like you saw this coming for hours.
No, no.
That was like, no. It was like this sudden thing where you're going into the enemy empire's castles and infiltration and you're suddenly ambushed. And it gives you this – the only dialogue prompt in either of these games that is a timed response. Like the dialogue pops up and enemies act and you have just enough time to like say get out of the way or whatever. Mm-hmm. So yeah, it like – Even if you go into this kind of expecting things, it's going to surprise you. Sorry if you've never played this 20-year-old game and I just ruined it for you, but
– But the thing is like the writing and production of this game, it's an indictment of war in the way that is just so tangible. Like you see like the evil villain sitting there and just slaughtering people wantonly and like
– Yeah, we need to talk about Luca Blight or
Luca
Bright,
yeah,
or
the,
whatever.
The greatest villain of – gaming, in my opinion.
I don't know about that, but he's definitely the most over the top.
Yeah.
More so than Kefka?
More so than Kefka.
Okay, Kefka never made an NPC, random villager, bend down and act like a pig and then lop its head off.
That's true. It's pretty dark.
Yeah, like he has like the beast rune.
Yeah.
And he
okay, maybe we need to talk about what the hell the runes are.
Okay.
So
in the universe of Suikoden, there are 27 true runes that were in the beginning of time, like the they were created and they used to create all the worlds. And then from these
think
runes,
infinity gems.
Yeah, or like, you know, any number of magical, mystical things. And of these runes, the people who carry these runes are like, you know, locuses of history and everything kind of warps and bends around them. And they each have their own personas and personalities and kind of like they impact the way the carrier acts. So for instance, and all the other runes, which are just like magical spell kind of things like fire runes.
Yeah, there's runes
fires.
And there's true runes.
Yeah, there's normal runes and they're all kind of birthed from these true runes. So like a normal fire rune lets you like, you know, cast fireball or whatever. The true fire rune lets you do an inferno that would like level a town. And so with these runes, like for instance, in the first game, you had the Soul Eater, which is like this incredibly deadly rune that takes, you know, like eats people to get power. In game two, you've got the Bright Shield and Black Sword, which are these attack and defense runes.
And those are actually aspects of a single rune.
Yeah, a single rune.
They're like the rune of creation or something like
yeah,
that.
Yeah, and similarly, there's like the teleportation rune. It's a there's a, like the rune of gates. And I mean, all these different runes that kind of make up
that
the
– Vicky has that, right?
Yeah.
And then Look has a true rune, doesn't
Look
he?
Gets the true rune of wind later.
Okay, but I thought he was like the main villain of the series.
He is.
Going to be.
He is. I don't remember that much of –
That's okay.
God, I haven't played Suikoden 3 in a long time, okay? So – but the point is though, like Luca Blight has one of these runes, a beast rune, and that just changes his personality from being a normal, you know, sadistic emperor into this just like wild berserker type of like uncontrollable evil. And he looks like the villain in Gladiator, you know, and he's just got this he's going through these towns and just killing people left and right for no apparent reason, but just tearing this world apart. And people are trying to get together and fight against him. And yeah.
Which does lead to one of the greatest final boss battles ever.
Oh,
like
yeah.
The multi-part battle against Luca Bright is amazing.
Oh yeah, it's so much fun. But yeah, so I mean that's basically the runes. The runes are like deeply important to the mythos of the story and change the way the game kind of like tells itself. And like the villain in the first game had like the rune of rulership, like some that rune that tainted him and made him into a crazy evil ruler too. Anyways.
But it's kind of the central narrative of like these concepts, these powers,
yeah.
Kind of treating you know, humans are kind of pawns to these greater concepts that control them.
I mean that's the thing. It's like there's a few runes that they'd like describe that are like you know, they make sense, they're meaningful, they have kind of resonance in the story. And then there were some that they're like, okay, well, here's the blue moon rune that right. turns people into vampires. It's a true rune because it
we
is.
We made it up.
And like you could tell that as they got later into the series that some of the true runes were just kind of getting a little But like the rune of punishment that you get in 4, for instance, it does damage to the opponent, but it does damage to you too for daring to use it. Mm-hmm. And I couldn't tell why that was different than Soul Eater just being like, but it's still, it was like, it was pretty cool. It was pretty cool.
Like looking back, I feel like the overall narrative on Suikoden 2 took what they'd done in the first game, but made it a lot more personal.
But yes.
Like, you know, because the first game was kind of about these, you know, grand, you know, political, you know, battles and war and warring factions. But this one, like, you kept going back to like the more micro and like letting you have more of a personal feeling about these characters and really, you know, not just being pushed ahead by like, oh, I want to collect all the characters, but like actually caring about your characters. And I think that's why people usually look to this one as like the high point.
For and the like the way Jeremy just mentioned the character Pilika, she's a little girl that you pick up outside of this town early on that burns down. And when
it's
you
burned down by Luca Blight.
Yeah, it's burned down by Luca Blight. And when you meet her first, she's talking. She's a young toddler. She's acting up. And then suddenly she's just silent for like a large chunk of the game until you meet this, you know, doctor character who kind of helps nurse her back. And at the end of the game, she's talking, and it's just this kind of like micro cycle that you're getting of the story of what it's like to be a child caught up in a war, see your family slaughtered, and then kind of come back to life over time with help and work. It's like you could tell the story writers of this game thought a lot about war and about what like what does it actually mean to have roving bands of like mercenaries in this world just killing people. Like you've got people who are just like, look, man, I'm just a humble town, you know, like policeman, but now I have to be caught up in this giant epic battle. What's going on? My wife's at home. She's still doing laundry. Can I go back to see her? Oh, if I go back, they'll die? Oh, no. Hmm. You know, I mean, it's just – it makes you consider every decision that you took for granted in an RPG because you have to sit there and think like, what would happen to this world if I do this otherwise common like, you know, battle, right? And I thought that was just amazing.
I mentioned earlier the quote-unquote final battle versus Luca Blight, which is the final battle against Luca Blight, but it's not the final battle
no,
in the game.
No,
but it seems
not.
Like it could be because, you know, even though you don't have all 108 stars of Destiny by the point you fight Luca Blight, it's like 30 hours into the game and, you know, if you've played the first game, you're like, well, I probably just missed a bunch of people. This is like – this seems like
sure.
the end. But it's not because – this is a story that's bigger than one person. And once he falls, like if you manage to beat him over this multi-part battle that your entire army basically has to take on one man to put him down.
It's so cool.
The war keeps going. Like the, you know, the kingdom that Luca Blight ruled, it's taken over by someone else and they continue the war. More civilly, you know, without the wanton slaughter of people.
Yeah,
but it's not over yet.
I
like just
really
because you killed the leader.
Of a precedent. Quite that way in previous JRPG where like you think you're fighting the last boss and there's, you know, a good 20% of the game left, you know, like
actually Tales of Destiny did that.
Oh, really? The first one did?
Yeah.
I even beat that, but I don't remember it.
Yeah, there's like what seems like a big final battle and you go back home and no, there's still more story.
Okay.
Oh yeah, Lunar 2 also did that.
That's true.
Yeah, there's like the whole epilogue.
I mean, you know, Final Fantasy IX does it to terrible effect later.
So I mean it's an idea, but here it actually really makes sense within the context of the story because it really is about, you know, war on the scale of kingdoms. And, you know, kingdoms don't stop – nations don't stop their forward momentum just because a leader dies.
Exactly. I mean, remember, the leader is the guy who's like, you know, doing crazy. But all the generals are the ones who are actually doing the actions.
Right.
And they've still got a good reason to want to attack.
Yeah, they had a lot of skin in the game.
Yeah, they're like, look, man. Just because he's dead, that means I've got now room to grow.
Well, it's interesting that these titles have this feeling of nation building, not, you know, far beyond a normal game where you're making a party, but you're literally making like a giant city and an army and like customizing it. You kind of do take this pride in like helping society
right.
in these games. Yeah. Well, and I don't want to skip ahead to the secret best part of this game, but it's the cooking minigame. Oh my
yes,
God, it's the best
the Iron Chef battle.
Well, and also it's important to remember this is, you know, 1997. Like Iron Chef was only a Japanese thing.
There
was,
no, it was not.
99. Well, it was, at this point, Iron Chef, they were showing the Japanese Iron Chef in America.
Yes.
But Iron Chef America wasn't a thing yet. Top Chef wasn't a thing yet. The idea of like a competition cooking show with a theme ingredient was a brand new crazy thing. And this game suddenly interjected this new character who was like basically an Iron Chef. And you'd have this fun cook-off minigame.
Okay, so let me tell you.
Wasn't Ore no Ryori like a PlayStation cooking game? Wasn't that already around the same time?
Okay, so in like the late 90s, Iron Chef
Full motion
in Japan,
video,
Iron Chef in Japan was like at its peak in the late 90s. Like they just introduced Iron Chef Italian. It was like the huge cultural phenomenon there. And over here on like Asian TV, we were getting NHK dubs of like Iron Chef with the subtitles at the bottom. And like – we were all addicted to this. And first, when I was in college 2 years later, my wife, who was my girlfriend at the time, she was like, you know, okay with games, but she wanted to play Suikoden too because she had watched me play through the first one. And we got to the Iron Chef battle and she just took it from me and played for like the next 25 hours.
She grabbed it from
me. Oh, yeah. She was okay, I need to go find every random pepper and seed in this universe.
That's awesome.
We need to go do all these battles.
What's the chef's name? Do you remember in the game?
No, I don't. But I remember just like the judging and like memorizing all the stats.
Yeah, and it's clearly based on Iron Chef.
There's actually
100%.
There's actually an Iron Chef parody in Star Ocean 2. And Iron Chef was not on TV in Ohio in 1998. But all the cool kids were like, actually, I know what that is. I know what the reference is. It's a Japanese
thing. I love Iron Chef, but that was just such a cool – I mean, okay, so yeah, that was a thing. So you had the same castle building in Suikoden 2 that you didn't want. You still got all your people. They did the things, but they realized that if you've got this big town that you built up, you should be able to do things in there. So we had this Iron Chef mini game that was obviously very famous. We had
– gambling.
The gambling games that were three different games. There was like a card game and a Mahjong-y type game. There was like underneath the bestiary area where you're – pet Leviathan, your octopus guy was.
Yeah, all right.
And like
was there an arena you could fight in? Or?
No, there was no arena in this one. But they really just made this into such – like it was a town. It wasn't just a castle. It was a town and every time you would go, it would grow up a little bit bigger. You would see new scenes. You would see new dialogues. And they went a long – like at the end of the game when you're like – they build a statue to your character that did the most damage. So for me, it was Shiro the Wolf instead of the main character, which is amazing. But they
even
really,
that little touch is cool that you could like have – you know, a castle looks different than my castle.
Yeah.
A different statue.
Exactly.
You know?
And I don't know. This game just went out of its way to make all of the things you liked about Suikoden 1 into even better things. So do you want to talk about the difference in the tactical battle system or what?
I don't remember.
It's slightly better.
So the tactical battle system in 1 was literally just
paper, rock, scissors.
If you played the DS game, not the 3DS, like Miiware game or whatever it is, where you've got like the soldiers that they have the battles where you meet, I forget what it's called, but it was basically just rock, paper, scissors. You're like, oh, his archers, my lancers, or whatever, right? In Suikoden 2, it was actually you have groups of like three or four people who are in a battalion and you're on a grid map and you walk forward and your team has like little powers that they can use to affect the guys kind of left and right against them. So it was more like a board game. It felt more like a grid-based board game with powers that you could then go around and walk around.
Actually more tactical, not just
– it was actually tactical. Yeah, it actually felt like – you had to sit and plan out the battle.
And I remember the duels were slightly more involved but still fairly simple.
The duels
simple.
Were effectively the same.
Yeah.
I mean the difference was maybe like just the texting but the you still had attack, crazy attack, or defend.
Right.
And I mean the fact that they were still there though, that was just such an epic part of the game. It was so cool. But the secret best part was the fact that you could go back to the capital city of the first game and recruit your hero and Gremio to join your party.
Ah, yes. The good old Dick Dole.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And so that's the thing. In Suikoden 2, right, you could import your save file from Suikoden 1. But there was a weird bug in the import that in the first game, whatever capital letters – if your character is – like when you create your character's name, let's say Zaminar, which is what my brother named my character. So capital Z, lowercase e. So we import into – 2 and the first capital letter overwrites McDowell's name. So it became Zick Dole.
It's really weird. I had Daisuke McDowell, so I got Dick Dole.
Right?
Dole.
And like I knew a guy who decided he was playing Pokemon at the time, so he named his main character Ash, all capital letters, A-S-H. So he got Ash-hole.
Good old Ash-hole.
And it was so silly.
Weird. But yeah, that was great because it wasn't just, you know, Return to Tauron. it wasn't just McDowell that shows up. If Gremio, if you got all 108 stars in the first game, Gremio would show up.
And give you a secret stew recipe for the Iron Chef game.
Of course. And then there were also other characters who would show up regardless. Like you had to choose between
Kasumi
a ninja
and
character.
Valerie,
I think. Oh, Valerie? Okay. Yeah. I mean, obviously I went with Kasumi because cute ninja girl.
Yeah, Valerie had the better sword.
Yeah, picture. Like, okay, fair enough. But yeah, like there were lots of opportunities to kind of – or not lots of, but this one like really interesting opportunity to revisit the first game and see what had happened following – the events of the first game,
yeah.
Like what does peace look like?
Yeah. And really, that is pretty cool. Like that impetus to be like, oh, if you did get everything, you can bring it over. Like so that's pretty rare to this day.
One of my favorite PC games ever.
Ark the Lad let you do that before that.
Right.
Ark the Lad 2.
And like the Quest for Glory games on PC let you import your character through.
And Wizardry before that.
Yeah, but it's just like in Japanese RPGs, like you never had a Final Fantasy VI character go into 7, into 8, into 9. But you could hypothetically take your save file from Suiko 1 to Suiko 2 to Suiko 3 because of, you know, PS2's ability to use PS1 cards. That's amazing. The fact that you had continuity that made the story just link together and just feel like chapters of an actual continuous story in a way that other RPGs just didn't do. Like I think Phantasy Star was like the other one that I just think of when I think of continuous like joint stories, because like each Final Fantasy is an individual game, each Dragon Quest is an individual game. But the fact that like they had the guts, I guess, to sit and make a story that so was standalone but linked back and gave you benefits as a person who is like – it's like a reward for having read the first book, right?
Hmm. Well, it's interesting. The context that Jeremy said at the very beginning of this podcast that, you know, this was by design, that they kind of got their feet wet with the first one and then expanded the scope for the second one, but always had the vision in mind. Like it's interesting. I never actually knew that.
Me neither.
And, like,
that's
I even
amazing.
Interviewed – I remember interviewing Junko Kawano for Suikoden 4 and she didn't talk about that. And she worked on the first game. She was a designer on it. But like I think that gives me the context that like now it all makes sense. It wasn't that like this happened in a vacuum or by accident. It was
that's
by
such
design.
A cool detail, man.
And I think that's a good way to approach games even now. It's like, oh, you have this grand vision, but you can kind of like, what's the minimum viable product to make like the thing I really want to make? And like Suikoden 1 is that. It gets the point across.
I mean,
it does most of the things that Suikoden 2 does.
It's a perfect game.
That's the approach I'm taking with Jetpack Goonies.
Yeah. Wait, is that a sequel to Jet Force Gemini and the Goonies?
Yes, absolutely. So I think we've pretty much covered the gamut here. There are a few little odds and ends. Like we could talk about Victor settling his score with Necklord once and for all the second game. Or
and the Necklord
like
song.
The you know, even though you're kind of meant to soak in this game and take your time through it, there's also the timed event where if you
go as fast as you can, you get the full Clive story.
Right.
Oh, it's like, so good.
I never did that.
Is that it?
Huh?
No, I don't want to rush through this game. I don't care that like, much about Clive's story.
How much do you have to rush to get
– You have to beat the game
really
in like 20 hours or less or something.
Haul ass.
You have to get to certain towns by certain hour marks in order to meet special NPCs who give you more
chunks
of the story.
Also, it's kind of like the Save the Queen quest from Final Fantasy IX.
Also, remember, like this was – you know, internet was around back then, but it wasn't the way it is now. Like a lot of these secrets were pretty well hidden.
Yeah,
I mean, there was a strategy guide.
Yeah,
like,
GamePax was beginning. But it just – We pass around these details, like you need to be in this town by 1542 or you're going to miss it. And it's just –
I think GameFax was still Secret of the Sega Sages back
I think
then.
You're right.
But it was just so – I mean Clive – just getting Clive was one of my favorite characters. I had to jump through all these hoops and get to these cities and meet these – it made you – they made you work for it. It was cool and it felt cool. And it was also, I think, one of the first games where I discovered what yaoi is because I went online looking for like fan art of Suikoden and it's like, oh.
You're like Gremio Cross. Oh, dear.
I thought Gremio was like a big brother to the main character, but I guess not.
Yeah, and it's like, oh boy.
Now you write this is different. You write light novels about these.
Yeah. Oh, God. So good.
All right. So we have some letters from listeners, but I think we're going to save those for the mailbag episode. and wrap this episode up. It's been what's the time on the clock, Bob?
1:35.
That's perfect. 1:35.
Do you think in the future we will go to the other Suikoden games? Because it's a mixed bag, but there's some things to be found in them.
Yeah, maybe. I don't know.
Here's the summary. Suikoden 3 is great. Suikoden 4 is garbage. Suikoden 5 is a prequel to Suikoden 2. So worth your time if you like Suikoden 2, which you should like Suikoden 2.
Yeah, 5 is worth your time.
Suikoden Tactics is one of the most disappointing games I've ever played. Tear Crease is not a Suikoden?
That's correct.
Suikogaiden.
Suikogaiden 1 and 2 are really, really cool story sequences that fit between 1 and 2. And I enjoyed them, but they're also a good way to practice reading Japanese.
Aren't they visual novels?
Yes, they're a visual novel.
Suikoden card game.
I have the full set at home.
No, the GBA game.
Oh, no. I've got the actual printed CCG. Okay.
Mm. The PSP game, earlier Bob was looking at it. I've never seen it.
I haven't either until now.
I've got it at home. Yeah, it's amazing. It came out when I was living in Japan.
Yeah, I've never seen
it. It's beautiful.
Before. Yeah, it's pretty good for a PSP game.
I fully recommend the Suikoden co-creator's other game. Well, she's done several games, but I really love Shadow of Memories /Shadow of Destiny.
Came out just recently called Alliance Alive.
Alliance Alive, yep.
I just picked it up because I heard it was by the
scenarios. Murayama.
Yeah, Murayama.
It's like Suikoden and Saga had a baby.
Is that PC or mobile?
DS,
dude.
What's it called again?
Alliance Alive. I just picked it up.
I work in the video game industry and I've never heard of that game.
Me neither.
Who published it? Like Atlas or something?
Atlas, yeah. Okay. They didn't promote it much.
You would think that a game by the guy who did Suikoden would be something that would be on my radar, but it was not. And now it is.
Shadow of Destiny, everybody. It's great.
Also,
it has one of the – I want to talk about Shadow of Destiny.
Good.
For fuck's sake. Let me talk about it.
It's also on PSP.
Yes, it is. Thank you. I had a nervous breakdown recently. So let me tell you about Shadow of Destiny. It's one of the best adventure game puzzles in adventure game history, in that in order to get people witnesses at a crime scene to avoid getting hit by a car, you have to go back in time and convince the director to make a less interesting movie so the witnesses will not be distracted by a poster for the interesting movie.
What?
And that is the solution to that puzzle. You have to go back in time and tell the director, no, make this more boring movie so people will not look at the poster. They will be there and they will witness you.
I need to play this game. What?
It's cool.
Yes.
It's weird.
It's like The Room almost. It takes itself way too seriously, but it's goofy as hell and I love it.
All right. So
music.
That'll speak for itself with the integration throughout the episode.
I mean, if there's a certain
don't worry in the letter bag, the letter bag episode,
the letter bag,
yeah. Letter bag. We're gonna get to letter bags.
Soundtrack is one of the greatest soundtracks in video games. I don't care. Fight me. You can find me on Twitter. But I'm telling you, I've got 18 of those CDs. I still listen to them to this day. The Celtic version, the Asian version, piano, the jazz version they did. This is Konami Kukea Club's peak, when they were doing Castlevania Symphony of the Night, when they were doing Suikoden, and when they were doing the early DDR stuff. It is magical. It is still one of the greatest RPG soundtracks of all time. I don't care what you have to say.
I want
to
hear the jazz arrangement.
It is hella good.
What's it called?
It's like Suikoden jazz arrangement.
All right. So that wraps it up for our Suikoden 1 and 2 episode.
Thank you,
Shane and Shivam, for coming in. And Bob, of course, for being here as always.
Hi, I'll play.
You're the rock upon which we built our church.
I'll play Suikoden 2 one day. I just need 60 hours and other things.
Yeah, I hear
it's really good on the Vita, man. If you take the PS Classic version,
I bought the damn thing just to say thanks for doing this, but I've only played a few hours of it so far.
All right. Well, sorry that I spoiled it for you.
I'll forget all of this.
Okay, great. So, yes, Retronauts. I am Jeremy Parrish. You can find me on Twitter as GameSpite and at Retronauts.com. Shivam, where can the humans find you?
People can find me at ElectroTal on Twitter. I'm there.
You should probably spell that out.
ElectroTal. I tend to talk about magic and politics more than Suikoden.
There's a silent K in there. You know, it's good to spell it out. This is Shane. You can find me on the Twitter at ShaneWatch, all one word.
Hey, it's Bob Mackey on Twitter, Bob Servo. Other podcasts include Talking Simpsons and What a Cartoon, and those are Patreon supported. And go to patreon.com/TalkingSimpsons. You'll find out everything we have to give you, and it's a lot, and I won't talk about any more here because it takes literally minutes to get through all of this. So thank you for your support.
Can I plug my other podcast?
No, yes.
That's what you're here for, dude.
Yeah, I host a podcast about the Magic format Commander. It's called Commanderin. You can find us at CommanderinMTG on Twitter and other places.
And finally, Retronauts, of course, is at Retronauts.com on iTunes, other podcatchers, and the Podcast One Network. And also, we are supported through Patreon. That's how we pay our bills and do our laundry. Retronauts is on Patreon at patreon.com/retronauts. Yes, that's very good. That makes sense. Mm-hmm. So
support
if
your
you
favorite
support
creators.
Us there for $3 a month. You can listen to these episodes a week before all the other humans and also listen with higher bitrate quality, which is great when you listen to an episode like this.
When I start
that has
screaming.
Amazing, yes, when Bob shrieks. No, that has amazing music integrated into it because, yeah, this music is all from Suikoden 1 and 2. That's what you've been enjoying. You've been soaking in it, and so have we. And we will be back next week with another podcast.
I didn't even get to talk about my Suikoden branded iPod that
We're
I got.
We're done. We're done. Stop.